Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Millions of Americans are drowning in debt. According to the latest Federal Reserve figures, consumer borrowing rose $14.6 billion in December from November to a total of nearly $2.8 trillion. $2.8 trillion. That's the highest level on record. This does not include mortgages and home equity loans. The average American owes about $8,900 in non-mortgage-related consumer debt. 62% of bankruptcies are due to medical debt, and then student debt has surpassed the $1 trillion mark. Late last year, the group Strike Debt announced plans to buy distressed debt for pennies on the dollar, but instead of collecting the debt from individuals, they wipe it out. Strike Debt is an offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Strike Debt recently paid $21,000 to buy $1 million worth of debt belonging to over 1,000 people. These were medical patients who owed $900 each for emergency room visits in Kentucky and Indiana. So how does this work exactly? This has gotten a lot of media attention. On today's Your Call, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the debt crisis in the U.S. Why are so many people in debt? Where does this stem from? And what can we learn about the debt crisis from the Strike Debt campaign? Today, we're joined by Hannah Appeal. She is an economic anthropologist currently working as a postdoctoral research fellow at UC Berkeley, and she's an active member of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland. And it's Hannah Appel. Nice to have you on the show. Thank you for coming in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Mike Andrews, a writer and an active member of the Strike Debt campaign, and he joins us from Brooklyn. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Ruth.
Nice to have you. And we're joined by Lewis Hyman, assistant professor in Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He has written extensively on debt. His most recent book is called Borrow, The American Way of Debt. And Lewis joins us from New York. Hi, Lewis. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. So, Hannah, let's start off with you. People are just drowning in debt in this country. And yesterday, we actually got a call from a listener who said, why would Strike Debt want to help people who buy things they don't need on credit card? So can we talk a little bit about that? I mean, where does most of this debt come from?
Absolutely. I think, in fact, you brought some of the crucial issues up in your introduction. There is a narrative about profligate consumers, consumers who are simply going into debt because they want the latest flat screen television or the latest Nintendo. And certainly there may be people out there who have those kind of spending issues. But as you said, 62% of bankruptcies in the U.S. stem from illness, from medical debt. And certainly people are not going out and having elective liver surgery, right? So what we actually see is what we might think of as the crisis in consumer debt comes from the most basic things people need to survive. So whether that's medical care, whether that's an education, whether that's a roof over their heads, these are the categories in which we see the most severe kinds of debts. And even for people who have credit card debt, often that stems from, I'm so overtaxed for my own tuition or my kids' tuition. I'm so overtaxed because my health care isn't adequate. So then I'm putting groceries on the credit card. So I think that it's important, it's really important, in fact, to change that narrative from one of irresponsible consumers to one in where we live in a society that doesn't provide for our basic needs in ways that allow us to thrive and flourish.
And Lewis, you write extensively about this issue. What would you add to that? Just give us a picture of how we can understand where this debt comes from.
Sure. I mean, I think that basically that's correct, and that we need to understand this not as simply the story of individuals making bad choices, but the structural conditions in our economy, whether that is medical debt, you know, the uncertainty of medical care or the need to get ahead and go to school. But I think it's also important to understand that it's not just about the way in which people borrow, but the decision to actually lend this money. Mm. That when we look at people borrowing, we're also looking at bankers and, you know, pension funds and hedge funds actually investing in consumer debt, as opposed to other kinds of debt that might be better for the economy, things like business debt, things that produce economic growth. And certainly for me, this is the main issue, that every time a dollar is put into consumer debt, it's a dollar not put into something that could provide jobs.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because whenever we do shows about debt, we notice headlines across the board that say, you know, either consumer debt is rising, which is really good news for the economy, or people aren't spending enough money on their credit cards, which is bad news for the economy.
Yes, it's half of the old demand and supply side, right? So it's understanding only one part of it. And to really understand the rise of consumer debt in American societies, I'm a historian and I've worked on this. This is what my books are about. You need to understand that it's about the shift from investing in things that make money, that are productive investments, like investing in businesses, to investing in things that produce nothing, like consumer debt, that it only forestall the eventual time when that debt has to be repaid. So it's so there's two parts to it. There's this way in which Americans, our wages have stagnated for the last 40 years, and so there is a lot of money that we are not earning, and so there's a need to borrow so that we can buy all these wonderful goods. But that stagnating wage has meant two things. It's meant that money's accumulated at the top, right? And that money needs to be invested somewhere, but that money is then invested in consumer debt. And so it's this terrible feedback loop that produces ever more demand for debt and ever more money to be invested in debt, and it's really gotten our economy off track.
How have things really changed since the economic crisis? Because it's really, it's astounding to think that this year about 1.25 million Americans will file for bankruptcy. That's equal to the entire state of New Hampshire. And then because of the rising cost of health care, we're talking about a bankruptcy every 30 seconds in the United States. So how have things changed since 2008?
It's absolutely appalling that nothing has changed, absolutely nothing has changed, that the fundamental underlying causes of the financial crisis, where most people are paid too little, too much money is accumulating, that in turn can't be invested profitably, right? So that money is being invested in consumer debt rather than in new enterprises, has meant that our economy is just going right back where it was again, that you're seeing again the rise in asset bubbles and in real estate, in the stock market, and that these things are just coming again to be undone. And the fundamental causes of this have not been fixed, that we've just focused on superficial kinds of finding the bad apples that caused this to happen rather than understanding the real movement of money in the economy.
I just wanted to add, if I could,
sure.
I think it's so important. I agree completely. If you look also at the lending side of things, and when you think about credit card debt, when you think about mortgage debt, when you think about payday lending, each is a tremendous source of profit for the financial industry, right? And those of us who are least able to pay, in other words, those of us who miss payments, those of us who accrue late fees, are in fact the most profitable debtors and their best customers. So I do think, exactly as Lewis said, that it's really important to look at both the debtor side and the creditor side as well.
And how have things changed since 2008? Is it getting worse for people? Based on these numbers, it's getting worse. According, again, to the Fed, consumer borrowing rose $14.6 billion in December from November to a total of almost $3 trillion. These are the highest levels on record.
I mean, I have to agree with Lewis again that what's getting worse is the fact that in certain ways, these ideas are on people's minds. There's an increased awareness, and yet there hasn't yet been any kind of recognizable systemic change. I think that's certainly what Strike Debt is working for. There are all kinds of organizations across the country and indeed around the world working for these kinds of systemic change. But the thing that has indeed gotten worse is that there's a sort of popular knowledge out there that something is wrong, and yet still sort of inability to create that structural change as yet.
Well, and Mike Andrews, you are an active member of the Strike Debt campaign, and Strike Debt is an offshoot of the Occupy movement. Talk a little bit about why so many of you decided to get involved and focus on debt.
Well, it kind of came together last summer after most of the camps around the country had been evicted, and there was a sense that Occupy Wall Street needed to kind of think about a different approach, a different strategy, rather than just having days of action. And so a number of us came together, started meeting in a park in Manhattan every week, and started talking about what kind of issues we could focus on to try to create more of a campaign rather than just a action hopping. And debt was really on everyone's lips, partly because most of us who were there had debt ourselves and were personally affected by it, We also recognize that debt affected almost everybody. In fact, does affect everybody, even if you don't yourself have debt. So we started talking about how to organize around debt. The conversations were slow, but seemed to have a lot of potential. And then what really I think the important step was beginning to have debtors' assemblies in parks in New York City, where people who had debt came out and talked about their debt. And it was just astonishing to see how emotional people got and how much the issue of debt affects people's lives. And because there's so much shame around debt, coming out and talking about it was a really momentous thing for individuals and for us as a group.
What did you hear? What were some of the themes?
Well, for one thing, I sort of naively expected most people to talk to be like young people in their 20s or 30s who wanted to talk about student debt. But in fact, it was people of all ages and people who were struggling with all kinds of debt. And one theme that ran through things is that people just had an unfortunate incident in their lives which caused them to fall deeply into debt. So maybe they got sick when they were between jobs or between insurance and had to go to the emergency room, and then they're $20,000 in debt. Or maybe they started a business that failed, and then they lost, and then they couldn't find new employment, and then they're in debt. So one unfortunate incident in your life, and you're saddled with debt, which you can almost never repay.
That is Mike Andrews. He's a writer and active member of the Strike Debt Campaign. Hannah Appel is an economic anthropologist working as a postdoctoral research fellow at UC Berkeley, an active member of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland. And Lewis Hyman is an author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt, assistant professor in Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And today we are talking about the debt crisis in the United States. The average American owes almost $9,000 in non-mortgage-related debt. 62% of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. Again, someone will file for medical bankruptcy every 30 seconds in this country. This year, over 1 million Americans will file for bankruptcy, 1.25 to be exact. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on debt? How have things changed for you since the economic crisis? How much debt do you have? And what are your thoughts about what we're hearing today, that things just really haven't changed when it comes to government action on this issue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And also, what do you think of the group Strike Debt? They buy distressed debt for pennies on the dollar, but instead of collecting the debt from individuals, they wipe it out. And we'll talk more specifically about how this works a little later in the show. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And also, if you have any questions about debt, again, we did get a call yesterday from someone who said, you know, I don't feel sorry for people who are living above their needs, above their means, and buying things they don't need on credit card. But as we've heard, most of this debt is coming from medical debt. That's when you look at the numbers, credit card debt is actually down. So what are your thoughts on that? And if you have any questions about debt, we'd love to hear from you. And so, Lewis, what could feasibly be done about all of this debt?
Well, I think there's some very clear policies that could work very easily. We could establish ways to securitize business debt that we don't currently have. You can't actually securitize small business debt. So as before, we just heard that a lot of the people who go into debt are not just medical debt, but also people who are trying to achieve that other American dream of owning their own business. And they can't get small business loans anymore because it is too easy. If you go to a bank, it is much easier to lend people money for their consumer debt than for business. And so they take it out on their credit cards, and the business, maybe it doesn't go right. Well, then let's make it easier to lend money to small business, medium-sized business. And the way to do that is to securitize small business debt, which, as we made through government policy in the 60s and 70s, possible for consumer debt, we've never done for small and mid-sized business debt. So nowadays, the only kinds of people who can borrow for their businesses are large corporations, which can issue bonds, or, you know, the very sexy startups can sometimes sell their equity for money. But for most other kinds of businesses, the ones that are successful, ongoing businesses, they can't actually borrow money to keep going, the plumbing supply store, the cheese shop, these kinds of places. And by enabling policies, by creating something that I've written about called Bobby Mac, something equivalent of Freddie Mac. Now, obviously, this has had bad connotations in the past few years, but it's more what the way in which we over-invested in consumer debt than the actual financial instruments that mattered the most. And so that we've tipped the scales too much on the side of consumer rather than business debt. And for me, this is the most straightforward, most important thing that we could do to make it easier for that money to flow into productive investments once again.
You know, we've done shows over the past couple of years about banks not loaning to small businesses. This hasn't really gotten much attention in the past 6 months or so. Is that still the case?
Yes, it's still the case that there's been, it's not a problem of will, it's a problem of structure. It's a problem of there being no secondary markets for business debt. And the way people talk about it, they say, well, every business is different. Well, every house is different. Yet we create standards. The standards originated with the FHA in the 1930s that made it possible for people in New York City to invest in houses in Texas. And businesses can also be talked about in a standardized way. It's called accounting. So let's create standards that allow these kinds of business debt to be traded. There was a saying in the 1980s on Wall Street, if it's gradable, it's tradable. Well, business debt is gradable. So let's just do this and let's make it. It won't be a magic bullet solution, but I think it'll take us a long way towards getting the economy going again and create less of incentive to push bad loans on people, because there will be a profitable alternative way to invest that money. And part of what we're talking about, debt itself is not always so bad. It's the pushing of bad loans on people who can't afford them that really is the dangerous part.
Yeah, and how prevalent is that still? I mean, how is that still happening at a very high level?
I think our the other two people would be able to speak to that better. But my impression is that it's starting all over again, that once again, money is flowing back into these places because there's no alternative.
Can you talk about that, Hannah, pushing bad loans on people? Where is this happening and how common is it today?
I mean, I think it's the same really interesting double narrative that we're talking about earlier. I've heard a lot on the radio recently that the housing market is rebounding.
Right.
You know, and there was a very controversial, I believe it was it Bloomberg Business Week, a cover recently that was sort of like an overtly racist cover. Well, Bloomberg didn't find it overtly racist, but almost anybody else who looked at it did, about the ways in which mortgages were again flowing to, as the cover suggested, black and brown people, and that this is what was, you know, sort of on the one hand reviving the housing market, and on the other hand, we should all be very scared. And so I think to the extent, certainly, it's really interesting. There's a woman that I've been talking to who's a colleague of mine at UC Berkeley who worked at the California Fed for a long time before coming into academia, and she was saying that in the original housing bubble, white borrowers and black and brown borrowers with the exact same credit scores were getting radically different mortgage packages. And she was saying that now, as we start to hear this rhetoric about the housing market coming back, we're going to see that similar trend. And indeed, Bloomberg sort of inadvertently publicized that with their cover. So certainly, I think you're going to see those practices again. And for the reasons that Lewis is saying, because banks sort of refuse to find other profitable avenues for their money. But I do think that it's also important to think about who, structurally speaking, who is forced to pay their debts, right? So we are forced to pay our debts. 1 in 7 Americans is hounded by a debt collector. Banks, on the other hand, bank bondholders, bank shareholders are very rarely, if ever, forced to pay the debts for their risky lending practices. So I think that would be another sort of systemic change that we would like to see. Certainly policy is one way. I think there's a lot of room for popular pressure on this to make banks accountable for their bad debts. And again, not simply sort of devolve that rhetoric onto irresponsible borrowers, irresponsible individuals.
And do you feel, Mike, that, I mean, as you said, when Occupy Wall Street got together with people who have a lot of debt, there's a lot of shame behind this, and so people don't really talk about it. But you are talking about a huge a number of people. I mean, 1.25 million filing bankruptcy. If these people spoke out, it seems like, well, you'd think politicians would have to listen.
Right. I mean, structurally, debt relies on the debtors being atomized. Not being not having essentially class consciousness, that they're all in a similar condition. And this is how exploitation works in the capitalist system, is that we also all face our exploitation individually. But when we find each other and we come together, that's really when we become threatening. And Strike Debt, our main objective is to build a debt resistance movement, and really the first step in building that debt resistance movement is finding each other and becoming aware that we are all in debt of various forms, and if we're not in debt, we're affected by the debt system, and that really the power lies with us, because if we default, if we collectively default, for example, do a strategic default, that is very threatening to our lenders. So that's, I think, a really important first step in building a debt resistance movement.
And we did a show a couple of years ago about this really great documentary called American Casino, and it looks exactly at what you just talked about, Hannah, just about how blacks and whites were given completely different rates for their loans. And so I highly recommend that. I think it's now out on DVD. We've got an email from Philip who says, what does it mean to invest in consumer debt? Lewis, do you want to take that one?
Sure. It basically means that, you know, you have some money to invest, like you want to invest it in stock or bonds. And that is how most of the debt that we're talking about is possible, because it is packaged. You go to your local bank, they give you a loan for a mortgage, then they put all those together and they repackage them as a mortgage-backed security. They sell the debt to somebody else, and it's in the form of a bond, which is a place, which is an investment. And so these people who run the pension funds, who run the sovereign wealth funds, they look at this bond for your consumer debt alongside all the other bonds that are available if they want to invest in bonds, whether that bond is issued by GE, whether that bond is issued by the U.S. government. And so to think about a debt as an investment sounds counterintuitive, right? Because normally from our point of view, it's a way to borrow. But where all that money comes from is that it is an investment. In fact, it's a good investment relative to other kinds of investments that are available. And this is the key idea, that it's not good in and of itself. It's only good relative to what else is available. And so if we figure out a way to make other kinds of investments have a better return for the same risk profile, then we'll be able to move that money away from consumer debt, right, and into things that produce jobs and better outcomes, I think, than just keeping this cycle of asset bubbles going.
And I think also just to relate what Mike said about building a collective debt resistance movement to what Lewis just said, certainly if debtors are able to band together in various forms of debtors' unions and there are mass strategic defaults, that consumer debt will not, the risk profile of consumer debt will change, let's just say.
All right. Yeah. Well, and I'd love to, if you're in debt, and I'm sure almost everybody listening probably owes some debt, what are your thoughts about this? And what about banding together as people who owe debt to really take on these issues? And if you have questions about who actually owes debt, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, we'd love to hear from you. Again, consumer borrowing rose almost $17 billion in December from November to almost $3 trillion, the highest levels on record. Credit card debt actually fell almost $4 billion. So what questions do you have about this? And we'll talk more about Strike Debt after this break.
This is Your Call with Rose Aguilar on KALW. To join in today's conversation, just call 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, please send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
This is is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Hana Baba will be filling in for Holly Kernan, having a conversation about how California's budget might promote economic equality, or maybe it doesn't. The Greenlining Institute has a new report out that analyzes California Governor Jerry Brown's proposed budget from the perspective of its impact on communities of color. They're calling it a mixed bag and saying that Latinos are expected to feel the most pain. So how will the budget affect communities of color? And then on Thursday, we're going to have a conversation about the plastics industry. I was recently at the San Francisco Ocean Film Festival, and there were so many great films about all of the junk and the plastic in the oceans. And so much of the talk was on individual responsibility to use less plastic. And I was thinking about the fact that not many people talk about the plastics industry. Who are the companies and the groups that actually make this plastic? So we're going to be talking about that on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the debt crisis in this country. 62% of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. Student debt has surpassed $1 trillion. We're seeing the highest levels on record. A lot of people think credit card debt is up there. It is, but it actually fell when you look at December to November. It fell by almost $4 billion. And these are latest figures from the Federal Reserve. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've got debt, what is your personal story? What do you think about the group Strike Debt, which announced plans to buy distressed debt for pennies on the dollar? Instead of collecting the debt from individuals, they actually wipe it out. We'd love to hear your personal story. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Hannah Appel. She's an economic anthropologist working as a postdoctoral research fellow at UC Berkeley, an active member of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland. Mike Andrews is an active member of the Strike Debt Campaign in Brooklyn. And Lewis Hyman, assistant professor in Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. He's the author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt. And I wanted to read an email from Stephanie in Berkeley. She says, thank you for the show on debt. I would call in, but fear I would be unable to speak through tears. I'm an underemployed PhD with a gainfully employed husband and two children. We lost our home 5 years ago and live with debt, which has been accumulated largely through expenses associated with a child with learning differences, expenses not covered by insurance. We've taken on debt because we're trying to do everything we can to help our daughter while she's young, and this might make a difference to her life. We're barely making it and have a great deal of shame about our economic situation. It's extremely painful to be in midlife with a strong education but little success in employment, debt, and a great deal of fear about the future. I have no sense of how to get help, either with debt, medical coverage for learning disabilities, or employment. I wish I could at least have my family understand that our debt is not due to an extravagant lifestyle. They've helped us somewhat financially, but I think see us as imprudent. Maybe we are. Mike, did you hear similar stories like this when you got together with people who were dealing with debt?
Yes, absolutely. That's so heartbreaking. Yes. I mean, Anna talked before about the need to change the narrative around debt. And I think that heartbreaking story we just heard is far more representative of why people go into debt and why people struggle to pay off their debt than this useful fiction of people being profligate consumers. When Strike Debt has received countless emails very similar to that one, we actually have a website called whyistrikedebt.tumblr.com, which has testimonials like that. And I think the more we emphasize that this is why people go into debt and have trouble paying back their debt, the more people will feel that the debt is, in fact, many forms of debt are not legitimate.
I also wanted to say, was the person who wrote the email named Rose?
No.
I'm sorry, she was in Berkeley.
Stephanie.
Yes. To Stephanie in Berkeley. Yeah. So we do have a Bay Area chapter of Strike Debt, and we do have regular debtors assemblies here. And we would love to invite you if you feel comfortable, and please know that there are always plenty of tears mm-hmm. at these debtors' assemblies, to come to our meetings and both to sort of find a community. And also, you know, we always say we provide resources and we provide resistance. So we can provide resources to you in terms of personal debt, and we can also provide you with a community that is coming up with creative ways to resist precisely the kinds of indebted situations you find yourself in. So you can, I'll give you contact info later, but just please know that there are a lot of us here in the Bay Area who are ready to form a community with you.
Well, and also, I mean, beyond that, and I think that's great to have a support system. Someone like Stephanie, when they're digging a hole because they have a child with learning differences, and this costs just astronomical amounts. I mean, I'm wondering, actually, Stephanie, how much you are paying for this. But, I mean, Lewis, what would you say to Stephanie? Is she just going to continue digging this hole?
I think she probably will if she's living in America. I mean,
wow.
This is the truth, right? That it operates structurally, but it's experienced individually. And the reason why she's in this hole is because in our country, we've tied all kinds of social services, medical insurance, you know, education, educational access in terms of wages and in terms of location, to our jobs. And in other advanced developed countries, this doesn't exist. Mm. So that, you know, if you lose your job, you don't lose your health care. You don't, and then you don't have all those bills, and then you lose your house. So, I mean, part of these things all compound on each other. And this is a uniquely American situation in a lot of ways, that it's the fact that we don't have all those other kinds of social services that actually restricts us from being more entrepreneurial, from having better businesses. And this is, it's important to say those things because it's important that it is understood as not a left thing or a right thing, but something that must be changed so that our economy can function in the global economy.
Steffi Wilhander, a doctor at the Harvard Medical School, who is for Medicare for All, she recently did a study on this and found that on average, you're talking about maybe $20,000 in debt for people who had insurance, and for people who don't have insurance, we're talking about $27,000 in debt. And again, 62% of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. And thank you so much for writing in, Stephanie. And check our website, yourcallradio.org, to find out how maybe you can get involved with one of these groups. Thank you so much for your email. And we have a caller on medical debt. Let's hear from Kat in Oakland. Hi, Kat. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for doing a program on this. When I first heard about striking debt, I was looking for information of maybe something starting up here in Oakland to get involved with, because I thought it was a very smart and savvy solution for people, especially people who are ambitious and don't want to, get another crutch with bankruptcy. My situation is a medical bankruptcy, but it isn't that I paid for my medical bills, because essentially I'm a house cleaner who's worked for 20 years for many public figures in the East Bay, many well-known people, and yet have, even though I've paid my taxes at a pretty high rate, I have no medical coverage, and so I'm being treated at Highland for cancer. The thing is I also have had credit and have always paid my bills, so I've been using my credit cards to augment I'm not eligible for any sort of, there's no work benefits, and there's no social service benefits if you haven't filed W-2s. Mm. You don't even get SSI. I did find a stipulation that allowed me medical GA, but I have to fight for it again and again every other month, which is really hard when you're in things like chemo and radiation and you don't have a car. However, I need to say that I'm really positive about, one, getting out of this. I'm almost at the end of my treatment, and I actually want to open up a very community-based business that I think could be profitable. I think if I got involved with the strike debt, I have a lot of skills I could offer, both for media decimation and just general social networking and making it a larger movement here.
Yeah. Well, and Kat, let me ask you a question, if you don't mind me asking.
Sure.
What do you make cleaning houses?
Are you saying per hour or annually?
Either.
Well, when you look at an hourly wage, please consider that it's not like a person who has a job with benefits where you really have to say that if they average a $20 an hour job, their benefits make it more like a $40 or even $50 an hour job.
Right, right.
And you also have to consider that I'm paying a tax rate as an independent contractor, as if, okay, so I make $20 an hour. Another thing is when I got cancer, my clients all left me.
Oh.
Not all. A couple have stayed on, but some have stayed on really just until they could find a replacement and would leave me suddenly with no, I mean, nothing.
Mm. And then just quickly, you're getting treatment at Highland. What have your bills been so far?
Well, my bills at Highland are free because I'm so destitute.
Okay.
But the thing is one, I don't live next to Highland. I'm in radiation now, so I've actually been able to get that closer because they don't have a radiology department at Highland. But, I mean, that's a different kind of subject and experience. But my debt that I've accrued have been paying for all the, you know, the additional things. And it was very quickly over $20,000.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Hannah, you've been shaking your head the whole time listening to Kat.
Yeah, Kat, I'm so sorry to hear about your story and your cancer. And I do want to say that the Strike Debt Bay Area is actually based out of Oakland. So please do get in touch with us. We'd love to have you and all the resources and media savvy, et cetera, you have to offer. So please get in touch with us.
Yes, and thank you so much for calling in, Kat. Let's go next to Nemo in San Francisco. Hi, Nemo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I worked at the Federal Reserve during the Clinton years, and when we started running a government surplus, I asked someone there, why are we still selling T-bills, auctioning T-bills, and adding to the national debt? And I was told that's because our customers demand it. Now, 15% of my tax dollars are going to interest on the national debt. It's a global scam. It's the new enslavement. Debt is the paradigm. And if you won't borrow to get your car or to get your education or to get your house, the government will do it for you and the banksters will not help you at all. So how do we default on the national debt?
Well, thank you for calling, Nemo. Lewis, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that if we defaulted on the national debt, our economy would collapse. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I think this is the thing, that it's very hard to think of ways to get us out of this that aren't apocalyptic. You know, I think we need to think about policies that steer us back towards the stability, long-term prosperity that we enjoyed in the post-war period. And it's in this moment, I mean, a lot of things we're talking about that we're hearing, we're really talking about the insecurity of lives in this neoliberal post-age of turbulence economy, the age after the 1970s, when wages stagnate, when we don't have just one job but many jobs over the course of our lives, if we have jobs at all. And what we need to do are create industrial policies that bring us back to that golden era of capitalism where people actually borrowed a lot of money, but they were also paid a lot of money and were able to pay back their debts over time. So rather than just focus on apocalyptic scenarios of massive defaults, I think we need to figure out ways to, you know, actually bring back paychecks to average folks, provide health insurance to people and those kinds of issues. And that's what I think about that.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Nemo. I mean, that's the other thing that we talk about on a regular basis on Tuesdays, what you just mentioned, Lewis. Lewis is an assistant professor in Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, author of Borrow, The American Way of Debt. Mike Andrews is an active member of the Strike Debt Campaign in Brooklyn. And Hannah Appel is an economic anthropologist, an active member of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland. And we've got a number of emails. Before we get to those, Mike, can you just briefly describe how the Strike Debt campaign works? And I mentioned in the intro that Strike Debt recently paid $21,000 to buy $1 million worth of debt belonging to over 1,000 people, patients actually, who owed $900 each for emergency room visits in Kentucky and Indiana. So how does this work and what are you working on right now?
It's complex, so I'll try to be as brief as possible.
Okay.
But Strike Debt is the organization, and this particular project you mentioned is called the Rolling Jubilee. And the way it works is, say that I go to the emergency room and I am uninsured and I am insured to have inadequate insurance, and I get $10,000 worth of debt. And say I can't pay that back, debt collectors hound me. Eventually, the hospital gives up on me paying it back. But instead of forgiving it, the hospital sells it into a shady secondary debt market. And in that secondary debt market, you can buy my debt for pennies on the dollar. So say someone might pay $100 for my $10,000 in debt. And then they will hound me, and they may have no hope of getting the full amount, $10,000. But if they get over $100 from me, then they make a profit. A member of Strike Debt named Thomas Gokey, who is an artist, was aware of the secondary market and came up with the idea of, maybe we can raise money and buy this debt. And a lot of research was done. We consulted tax lawyers, had to form a nonprofit. But over about 6 months, we were ready to buy this secondary debt in the secondary market. And we decided to focus on medical debt because it's such a huge problem. And we held a fundraiser in November. And our objective was to raise $50,000. We raised that before the fundraiser ever started. And now we have roughly $575,000 raised, which has the potential to abolish $11 million of debt. Now, the debt buying is actually a very complex, very slow process, so it's going to take a lot of time for us to actually discharge that $575,000. But, yes, as Rose mentioned, our most recent buy was $1 million of medical debt. When we buy this debt, we send the debtors a letter from Strike Debt, and it says and explains that we bought your debt and that we are canceling this debt as an act of mutual aid. And that they don't owe that debt anymore.
And are these random people? How do you find them?
Well, in the secondary debt market, you basically buy blocks of debt, and you don't know the identity of the people whose debt you're buying before you buy it. Otherwise, you could buy your own debt, which is
right.
Which is too bad that we can't buy our own debt.
But yeah.
We've been trying to spread it around geographically. Our first buy in November, which abolished $100,000 of debt, was in New Jersey in the Northeast, and the most recent buy, the buy in March, was in Indiana and Kentucky. That's right, Indiana and Kentucky, and it was all emergency room debt.
Wow! And what's the response been?
Well, we haven't yet heard from, as far as I know, we haven't yet heard from any of the debtors whose debt we have canceled, and we're very careful about their privacy. But
oh, okay.
I think. People have, but in general, the public, I think, this has got a lot of publicity, I think, because it's a way to sort of use the debt system against itself.
We have a question from a listener who says, what's the average debt amount of the people you help?
So the most recent debt buy, the buy in March, where we abolished $1 million in debt, that debt belonged to 1,000 people, and their average the average amount they owed was $900.
Okay, well, wow. So you can get more information. We have a lot of people who are writing in saying, I love you, Strike Debt. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. What can I do to get involved? And you can find links on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have just about 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure we have a ton of questions about debt. So let's take a call, and then we'll go to emails. Let's hear from John in Marin. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. This isn't exactly about eliminating debt. But, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that for such a large amount of this is medical bills, just to first say that it's very difficult for people who have medical disabilities and whose bills are due to medical issues to come forward and talk publicly about debt. It's particularly hard for us because we're expected, in order for other people to understand this issue, to talk about things that hospital systems spend millions of dollars keeping private.
Right.
Our medical records are private. So, you know, all of us get credit for speaking up about that. So my case, I'm faced with going into medical debt because Medicare, for example, doesn't pay for a wheelchair if I can walk a short distance within my home. Mm. I can't walk outside of my home. I have children. I'm no longer able to work. So I'm faced with a choice between paying my mortgage. I'm a professional person who bought a disability policy. I was wise to do that. It means I can pay my mortgage. But if I choose to buy a wheelchair and a van in hopes that perhaps I'll work or do other things productively, I'm faced with not being able to pay for childcare, mortgage, and all the other essentials. So I just want to put that out there, and thanks for your time.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. You know, you just reminded me of this article Stephen Brill wrote for Time magazine. It was a 26,000-word story, and the question was, why exactly are the bills so high? It took up the entire magazine. It's the first time they've ever done this, and it sold wildly. And I'm glad you brought this up, because we've been meaning to invite him onto our Friday show, so we'll do that soon. And thank you so much for sharing your story, John. We've got a number of very... Just people want sort of an FYI on debt. We've got an email from Zoe in Berkeley who says, no one's mentioned the word interest yet. My husband has a good job. I'm a stay-at-home parent to three children. One has special needs. I work part-time also. We've gone into debt for student loans and expenses related to normal life. The amount of interest we pay each month for the student loan debt as well as other debt is high enough to make a big impact on our income and the amount we spend on normal expenses. Please talk about this. Hannah?
Yeah, so I think... Mike just illustrated and did a wonderful job of explaining so clearly one specific tactic of strike debt, which is this idea of the rolling jubilee. But as he's also said, the broad strategies and tactics behind strike debt emanate very far out from the rolling jubilee, including what this caller or what this emailer is writing about interest rates. So, for example, if we begin to band together as debtors, one thing we realize is that these contracts are negotiable. Interest rates are negotiable. Banks know that interest rates are negotiable. But again, because we're so atomized, because we're so individualized, because we're so full of shame, very rarely would we understand, hey, wait a minute, I can renegotiate that interest rate. And if there are 700 of us all with the same bank and all with the same, then we can, or if there are 7,000 of us, et cetera. So,
who do it on the same day, maybe.
Exactly. I mean, right. So I think there are sort of medium-term direct actions like renegotiating interest rates, like targeting fees, whether those are usurious overdraft fees like payday lending that really have a chance of success and will show us that, in fact, these things aren't sort of moral failings, but are actually contracts that can be renegotiated through collective action.
Well, and to that point, we have an email from Jeff who says, I wish the people in this movement would focus energy on how to assist people with appropriate financial planning to avoid debts that are avoidable. I'm a person who mistakenly thought a fourth-tier law school degree would secure a certain financial future. Now I'm $125,000 in debt and have no greater prospects than prior to incurring the debt. Thousands of us are continuing to make the same mistake, assuming online education and other educational investments will pay off when they rarely do. How much has non-essential higher educational costs damned future generations? Lewis, do you want to take that?
Yes, I think that's, obviously I'm in education, I believe in education, but I think that part of the problem we're encountering in our economy is that we built an economy that unless you have a very elite kind of education, you go into finance and things like that, you are basically not part of the growth of the economy. We are no longer okay just to have a regular job and be able, and through that regular job, being able to provide for a family. This is the core of post-war America, that you could have a good union manufacturing job and be able to have a relatively good life. Now people go for the ring. They take the long shot, and everyone becomes a lawyer. Everyone becomes, a lot of people try to be. Everyone tries to go to college. Well, I think it's important to say, well, what is it in our society that makes it the only time you can have that kind of security, that kind of prosperity, is through a college education? And obviously a lot of people who go to college don't end up with that security even with that education. So this is, again, part of this larger conversation we need to have, in which debt and work are intimately connected.
And we were talking earlier about Stephanie digging a hole, and when you look at how much tuition fees are going up in schools, it looks like young people are going to continue digging themselves a hole as well.
Absolutely. It's a very challenging future, especially as states withdraw funding from higher in California.
Right.
All the money that's being put into prisons instead of being put into the university system.
Exactly.
Right. This is almost a direct kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Where we say, if you think that prisons are going to develop the economies of tomorrow, then, I think you're sadly mistaken.
$50,000 a year on prisoners and $8,000 a year on average on students. We're talking about the California budget tomorrow, so be sure to tune in for that. Mike, did you want to jump in?
Just briefly, I think the last two personal stories that you shared, I think, underscore the fact that People now have to go into debt to meet their basic needs. I believe that the first personal story you shared, she specifically said that she's gone into debt just to meet their basic needs. And a fundamental part of Strike Debt's analysis of the debt system is that we all now have to go into debt to have a decent standard of living. And debt, therefore, masks the failures of our larger economic system. So it's important that we see debt not isolated, but as connected to a larger systemic failure.
And we've got just a few minutes left for final thoughts. Mike, what's in store for the future of the Strike Debt campaign?
We'll continue doing debt buys. We'll have another one in a couple of months. And we had a march last weekend and a health fair to highlight our inadequate medical system. And there's talk about forming a debtors union as well.
All right. And Hannah, final thoughts from you. You talked about renegotiating interest rates. We also have a question from a young person who wanted to talk about how to get out of debt, just sort of what can I do, basic things. Anything else on your list?
Sure. I think one resource to which I would draw people's attention, if you go to strikedebt.org, you can download for free something called the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. And that resource is divided into chapters. So one chapter is student debt, one chapter is medical debt, one chapter is mortgage debt. And it will actually give you line by line tips on what you can do, from the absolutely legal and conservative to the more radical banding together. And I just want to say, adding to what Mike said, Strike Debt is expanding across the country. We do have a very active chapter here in Oakland, and I would encourage everybody to reach out wherever they live and see what's going on where they live.
All right, thank you. And Lewis, final thoughts from you. What can we do about this, and where is it going?
I agree with the other callers. It's important that we change the narrative of debt, that we stop thinking of it as something that we are individually responsible for, and we understand that it's part of our economic system, and push our lawmakers and anyone who will listen, really, to think of it that way, to understand that we can't change it in isolation away from these other considerations in the economy of work and of business. As soon as we begin to have those conversations, we'll be able to fix the crisis, not just for people who are in debt, but also for the people who lend the money, for the larger structures of capitalism.
Lewis Hyman is assistant professor at Cornell University. His latest book is Borrow, the American Way of Debt. Mike Andrews is an active member of the Strike Debt Campaign. And Hannah Appel, an economic anthropologist, is a member of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your many phone calls and emails. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you, but we will put your stories on our website so you can all read them at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up on Your Call tomorrow.
How can California's budget promote economic equality? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about budgetary priorities. The Greenlining Institute has a new report out that analyzes California Governor Jerry Brown's budget from the perspective of its impact on communities of color. They call it a mixed bag. Latinos are expected to feel the most pain. So how will the budget affect communities of color? And what do you think of measuring it through this lens? It's Your Call with Hannah Baba and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.